I've already talked about this for two episodes, but hey, what's a third? I started a project called Nerdy Day Trips, or rather rebooted it, and it's going gangbusters, I think. When I say gangbusters, I mean on a very small scale. We just hit 1,000 pull requests on the repository.
Wow.
Which is not bad after a month. I mean, a lot of them are new venues that have been added to the database, and quite a lot of them are pull requests that either delete places that have closed or are blatant advertising or spam or whatever we think it is that's not, you know, a place that nerds might go. And a lot of those edits and deletions were done by Hugo, who I've mentioned previously. Thank you, Hugo.
Which is a different Hugo to the website powering this whole thing.
Yes, we did mention that last time. It's not Hugo the binary, it's Hugo the human. And it's been very enjoyable. I wanted to mention a couple of things that happened. I created an ad page, which means people can add new venues. And so it's just a form you fill in. And over time, I've been iterating on this to try and refine it a little bit and make it easier to use. Like, initially, it was just a form, and then I added a map that you could drag around and click on places to get the latitude and longitude rather than type it in. I also made it so that you could paste in an OpenStreetMap URL, and it will get the lat long from that, and the name of the place as well, potentially. And so I've tried to refine it, like, multiple times because people have pointed out, oh, it's a little bit difficult to use on the phone, or it doesn't quite do what I'd expect, and the zoom isn't quite right. And so I've been iterating on this over time. And this whole process of noodling with something in an IDE, testing it on my local machine, and then just pushing it straight to main, and boom, it appears on the internet very soon afterwards, is quite joyous, actually.
One thing I think you changed, which was the main thing that bugged me when I tried to add something, was the map originally behaved a bit strangely, I thought, because when you moved the map, there was a pin which started, I don't know if it was your location or whatever, but you moved the map and the pin didn't move with you. So you found where you wanted to add, and then you had to go all the way back to find the pin and move it all the way with you. But I think now you've changed that, haven't you?
Yeah. So initially I put a map there and there was a marker and it was just zoomed in on a random place. It was just zoomed in on central London.
Right.
And there's a few things wrong with that. Moving the map means the marker stays where it is in London.
Yeah.
So you have to zoom out and then drag the marker to the place. And so I scrapped that. So now what happens is the marker stays in the center of the map and it's big. It's bigger than, you know, the normal markers. It's twice the size and a different color. And you drag the map around. And as you drag the map, the marker stays in the middle and the latitude and longitude is wherever the marker is in the middle of the screen.
Right.
And so you can zoom in and zoom out by the pinch on a mobile or mouse wheel or whatever, move the map around and find wherever the venue is that you want to add. That was an improvement, definitely, and that's made it an awful lot easier. The other thing is you can now see the existing markers on that map. So it makes duplicates a lot less likely. And I also made the markers that are existing places a different color. They're blue and the big marker is green, and it's a different size as well. So people who are colorblind, it's not so much of a problem because it's a different size.
I think it's interesting that you described that whole deployment process as joyous, because if we track all of this back to the very beginning of sort of your coding journey on this podcast, you started with the joy of code, which was writing some PHP on a locally hosted machine, and you could just hammer away and immediately see the, you know, the product of what you'd been making. And here you are months, it must be years even, further forwards, and it's actually the joy of using quite contemporary development workflows and deployment mechanisms and all the cloud native and worker service stuff. And you, I know you're getting genuine joy from this, because I see you grinning like an idiot every morning when you tell me about, you know, the new features you've been working on.
Yeah, I think I found that place where previously I was like noodling with a bit of PHP, like you said, and there was an episode in the past called Joy of Code. And I talked about, I just want to bang something out and have a play with it. And that's exactly what I did with this. Like, it's been a month since I published the first commit and put it online. And yeah, 1,000 commits on that repo. And that doesn't even include the commits on the other repo for the add new venue page. That's a whole nother load of commits. And today, a thing that I'm quite pleased with is What was happening was someone would create a new venue, either by adding it using the form that I created that I was talked about earlier, or manually, like a caveman, by creating the necessary front matter that you'd get in a Hugo page. Some people are more familiar with using Git on the command line and so can contribute that way. Now, if you went through the form, then that would create a pull request, but it did it with my key. And so it looked like my commit on the repo, which isn't great. I would rather it didn't use my GitHub token to do that. So I'm changing that. What I've also done is it would then deploy that unmerged change to a preview on Cloudflare. And so you could go and see and make sure that it deployed okay and that the point on the map is correct and the description looks right and it hasn't broken anything, which sometimes happens. And I changed that today. So it now uses two things. It uses a bot account. So it won't always show up as me. It will show up as Nerdy Day Trips bot with the logo in the username. And also I've switched off the preview in Cloudflare because that only ever ran with commits that were on my name because the Cloudflare account is in my name. And long story, can't really change that. So what I did is I created a GitHub action. So anyone who commits a venue, whether it's directly in GitHub or via the form, it will then spin up Hugo, build it, and then deploy it into GitHub pages. And so I can just use GitHub pages and it will show you a URL as a comment, and the bot will do that as a comment in the pull request. You click on it, preview it, make sure it looks okay, and then that can be approved, reviewed, merged. When it's merged, there's another part of the GitHub action that then deletes the deployment that's been done from GitHub pages, so it doesn't hang around, so it cleans up after itself as well. And then once it's merged, Cloudflare picks it up and deploys it to the proper site in Cloudflare.
Previews are going to GitHub pages. Ah, nice. So a nice bit of automation you could consider, something I've been looking at today, is Claude the AI has a GitHub action to automatically do like code reviews, but you can provide some additional context as to what the nature of the code review is. So, you know, you could maybe automate away some of the double checking on the quality of the preview page and, you know, the content.
Yeah, I could. And I think some of it actually is quite simple rules-based stuff, you know, because it is just TOML or YAML or whatever it is. And that is syntactically relatively strict. And there is only a limited number of tags that we support. And so I could put rules in with a bit of regex or something for each line and just say, you know, does it look like this? Does this one look like this? Is this one got numbers in it? Is this one numbers between 0 and 90 or like minus 180 and plus 180? And there's your lat long, you know. And eventually what I might do is if someone submits a place that is exists very close to another place, maybe highlight that and point like these two latitudes and longitudes are very, very close together. You know, you could do that calculation and say, are these the same place? And it, you know, have some way of merging them automagically. You know, someone might have done a description. And actually, if you took both of those descriptions and fed those into an AI and turned it into one description, that might be good. But then it might also be factually inaccurate and made up. And, you know, so there's a bit of a problem with putting public data generated by AI, but I think the sanitization of everything is not too bad. But yeah, it's been thoroughly enjoyable. There's a whole load of venues been added, mostly in the UK. There's a lot in Japan, the US, Australia, a couple of extra ones in New Zealand. They're kind of all over the place. And there was a cluster that were added in India this week as well. So yeah, it's getting around. It's not like, you know, super popular. It's not, certainly not as popular as the original, but then I don't really want the whole world looking at it right now because the CSS is a bit janky. The automation's a bit janky. Everything is a little bit janky.
Part of its charm.
Yeah. Well, thanks. It's all inconsistent styling and there's no like visual identity and all that kind of stuff, but we'll get there.
And have you found any interesting venues which you are now planning to visit, which have been added?
Yes, loads. And you've just reminded me by saying finding, you've just reminded me, I'll come back to your question. Stuart contributed a search page and I've iterated on this search page. Initially, it was you just type in the name of a place, like you type in museum and it would just list all the museums. Mm-hmm. What I've done is put a map on the screen and you can press a pin to get it to go where your location is, or you can just move the map around if you don't want to, you know, give the browser your location. And if you do a search, it sorts the search list by closeness to your location.
Oh, nice.
So if you zoom in and do a search, then the ones right at the top will be the ones that are nearest to you, and it tells you in brackets how many kilometers away they are.
Yeah, that's quite cool.
I was quite pleased with that. And the answer to your other question, which is yes, I've found loads of places that I want to go, you know, train museums and all kinds of flight places, especially when people put the URL of the venue, their own website, which is obviously, you know, trying to attract people. But it's great because I go to these websites and there's all science stuff, and then there's big steam engines, and there's like all the nerdy stuff. Plus there's museums and outdoor spaces and maker spaces and all this kind of stuff. It's I'm loving it because, yeah, I'm learning about all kinds of stuff all over the world, wherever it is. And, yeah, I will never get to see all of them. Well, never say never. That could be stage two. Yeah. So, yeah, it's been good fun. And if you know of any places, please submit them. And if you find any bugs, just file issues, because we are turning those around, you know, relatively quickly given how few people are working on it.
Long-time listeners to this and a previous podcast may know that I have for a long time had an Entroware Apollo laptop.
Is this one that's been in pieces and been repaired?
I don't think this one's actually been in pieces to repair it, but it has died on me a few times, just inexplicably. The last time was in the middle of OgCamp when I was just about to do a presentation. Nice. So that was fun. And the CMOS battery died, and then I replaced it, but it still said it was dead. So now it wouldn't boot unless it was plugged in. Basically, I got to the point where I couldn't rely on this anymore, and I needed a new laptop.
What did you get, Mark?
So after careful consideration and a lot of saving, I purchased a Framework 13.
Ah, you've been looking at these. I think you've been fantasy shopping these for at least 4 years at this point.
Basically, yes, as soon as they were like initially announced, and then I was sort of waiting to see if they were actually going to stick around and be sustainable. And then they iterated a few times and they brought out an AMD version. And I thought, yeah, this actually looks like it's going to stick around. And yeah, about a year later, I finally managed to get one.
Did you get the one that you build yourself, or did you get the ready-made one?
I got the one that you build yourself for a few reasons. One, for the fun, but also, so basically, you don't build it completely from scratch. So you get a chassis with the monitor and like the basic parts, like the main board and the audio out and the battery and things, which I guess they don't want to support people installing themselves, because you could get that wrong. But then all of the sort of customizable bits you get to pick, and then you get to assemble. So the RAM and the SSD and the keyboard, the bezel around the screen, and the expansion ports, which are basically specialized USB-C dongles that plug into the internal USB-C ports and give you the external ports. You get to choose, well, there are four ports and you get to choose as many as you want, basically. So I got that. The reason partly to build it myself, but also because I didn't need everything. So I didn't need an SSD because I already had a nice big one. More on that in a future episode. And also I had a look at the options for RAM and I realized that I could save myself a few quid by buying third-party RAM.
Right.
So I did that. So I ended up buying the chassis, the expansion cards, the bezel, the keyboard, and nothing else. And the other bits I got separately.
How was the process of putting it all together?
Very nice and very easy. The RAM slots in under a couple of like thermal covers. The chassis comes with like a plastic cover over all the bits, which are all labeled. It's almost a shame to cover it up. It looks really nice. And then in a separate box, you get they call it the input cover, I think, which has the keyboard and the touchpad and the panel all integrated together. And then you get the bezel, and then you get each of the expansion cards separately. The bezel is magnetic, so you just sort of locate it in place and put it on and close the lid, and it all snaps nicely in. You can't easily sort of pick up the edges and accidentally pull it off. And the input cover, you connect the cable up internally and then you just sort of position it about right and it kind of clunks into place. And then there's five captive screws on the underside so they can't fall out and get lost. And then you just do them up and it's done.
Nice.
So, after carefully choosing your specification and assembling your parts, obviously now you need to choose your operating system. So, which was it, Windows 10 or Windows 11?
Vista.
Of course.
I'm retro. So I stuck with Ubuntu, which is what I'm familiar with, and it's one of the supported options. I think they support Ubuntu or Fedora as Linux options. And there's some quite nice documentation on their website. You know, there's not a lot to worry about, but there's a few things like some people have had issues with the, as well as the expansion ports, it's also got an audio jack, and some people had issues with that buzzing, and there's a thing you can do to stop that. And they have some notes about enabling firmware updates, because you can update the firmware with FW Up Manager, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
FWAPD,
that one. Yes, which I've done, and it works quite nicely. There's a few other bits about explaining the power consumption and what you should or shouldn't do to optimize it, and some things like that, which is quite nice. They've put some thought in. There's not a lot they have to do in terms of documenting it, but things they have to do, they've taken the time to explain things properly. It's not just like, here's a page they pulled off the Arch Wiki and slapped on their website. Right, it's like, here's what you should do and here's why you're doing it, which is nice.
Yeah. It's nice to have a vendor actually having sort of the authoritative version of this is what you should and shouldn't do to get the best out of your machine, rather than, you know, hunting around for random blogs of people that have bought something similar in the past.
Yeah.
So I know you work from home, so I guess this mostly sits on a desk or some other flat surface in the house or your lap. Have you had to like take it to an office or take it on the train or take it anywhere for an extended period of time? What was it like? Is it suspend and resume okay? A battery life, the usual, you know, things we worry about on Linux laptops?
Yeah. So this is my personal laptop, not my work laptop. So far I've mainly used it on the sofa. Right now I've got it in the laptop stand on my desk, plugged into my big monitor via USB-C. Works very nicely, which my old laptop didn't. Battery life, I've not like used it for a whole like battery cycle. I usually use it for a bit and then suspend it. It does suspend and resume okay. I've not tried Hibernate yet because it comes with Secure Boot enabled, and Hibernate doesn't work with Secure Boot. But I mean, the battery lasts several days on suspend based on my non-scientific experimentation. But a lot of because it's USB-C, a lot of the time where it sits downstairs, there's a USB-C cable there, and I just plug it in when I've used it and let it charge up overnight. So I can't give a firm answer on that. I don't think it's, you know, wildly like Apple Silicon MacBook Air style battery life, but it seems similar to what you'd expect from a Linux laptop.
So given this is your personal laptop, what was the first roguelike that you ran on it?
Yeah, so this is something I've still got to try out is gaming. I got an AMD Ryzen edition of this.
Wise.
Which has an integrated GPU and NPU, which is a neural processing unit.
Oh, it's got one of the new AI processors.
Yes, so the GPU is supported out of the box. So I've sort of tinkered with it a bit, but I've not tried seriously playing anything on it yet. The NPU, from what I can tell, the AMD drivers do support it, but the only sort of application that uses it is for training LLMs, essentially. There's nothing which uses it for doing end user operations that I can discern. Whereas on Windows, it's meant to be for like, if you're doing, I don't know, photo or video manipulation or things like that, I think is the idea of what it's meant to be used for accelerating. But I have been able to use my GPU for accelerating stuff, just trying it out.
How long's the warranty on it? And did you pay for any extended warranty?
I believe it's a year and no.
Okay, so we should make a note to check in with you in a year's time and see how well it's going, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the good thing is if anything does break, I can get replacement parts, which is my main reason for wanting this, because I always get frustrated after a few years of having a laptop if something breaks. I mean, I once managed to get a replacement motherboard shipped via AliExpress, like about 4 years after, but then that was like it. There were no other parts available after that. Whereas hopefully I will be able to continue repairing and upgrading this for years to come.
Yeah. And if the RISC-V revolution happens, you can just slap one of those into the same chassis.
Yeah.
My wife and I have finally run out of patience with Gmail. and we have left Gmail and moved our email elsewhere.
Outlook?
No, not Outlook. We have really struggled with Gmail in recent years. And I think the last, I don't know, four jobs I've had, Gmail has been like the heart of the email platform. And I really don't get along with it. I have to turn off all of that promotions and updates and nonsense stuff to try and reclaim much of a sort of traditional email experience. But Louise gets deeply frustrated with the way that sort of emails get hidden from you. So replies to replies sort of get buried pages down in the original sort of opening email, and she can never find these things. And I've experienced this as well. It's deeply annoying if you get a bunch of updates all together. You don't get discrete emails. They all sort of get randomly collapsed together. And in recent times, we've noticed that the spam filtering or spam detection on Gmail is really not very effective anymore. We've been getting loads and loads and loads of stuff sort of leaking into the inbox that in years gone by, that sort of thing would have got hoovered up. So my feeling is that Gmail is the modern day Lotus Notes. It is capable of sending and receiving email, but it is not well suited for being an email client.
That is quite a bold insult to call Gmail Lotus Notes, yeah, or Domino. I would have called it Lotus CC Mail if I was going to push it, because we are going to get emails from people who do use Domino right now.
I used to use Lotus Notes back in the day, and it was an abysmal experience, and Gmail is just as bad, if not worse, in my opinion.
Contact Martin at
gmail.com.
And the other thing is that a bit like when I talked about paying to use the Kargi search engine to pay for search, where it breaks up some of the profiling and fingerprinting you're getting through the search engine providers, because their whole business model is to service you, the customer, with good search results, not to mine you and your behaviors. One of the other considerations here is my daughter is about to get her first personal email account, and I didn't want that to be on Gmail. I wanted to be on a platform where she has some control over, you know, what happens, and she can make choices about her email use in the future. So with that and a little bit of research, we decided to go with Fastmail. And somebody in the Linux Matters Telegram channel, and sorry, I don't remember who, sent me their referral code when I was deliberating over this months and months ago. And I did use your referral code, so somebody got a kickback. So thank you for that. And the whole process was really simple. I seem to remember filling in a form to sort of say we wanted to sign up, and got a couple of emails which had complete setup installation instructions. One covering the initial setup, and the other, because I'd ticked the box saying I was going to bring my own domain, had some instructions about how to set up a custom domain and DNS and stuff.
So was your Gmail account getting emails to a custom domain rather than at gmail.com already? Or was this something that you were doing as part of the migration?
Yeah, so I think about 12 years ago, I joined the Google Workspace thing when it was a free platform, when anyone could have a Google Workspace with a custom domain for free. And we got grandfathered in on the continuation of that. So our custom domains are currently in a Google Workspace. And I have to say, going into this, I was a little bit concerned about unpicking all of that and what this impact might be on our Google accounts, which are also used to authenticate other things. As it turns out, it couldn't have been easier. So once I'd got the new Fastmail set up, I created accounts for the three of us in Fastmail. So this is, you know, name at domain. And then I added all of the additional domains we have, because we have several domains and a whole bunch of aliases. So at this point, it's not doing anything, because this is just setting it up within Fastmail. It just happens to know these accounts exist and that these domains exist. But the whole time it's moaning, saying none of your DNS records are pointing to the right place. And then I went through the little document that explains how to update your DNS records. And they've got specific instructions for a number of the popular providers. And if all of this DNS stuff sounds like, you know, horribly scary, Fastmail can also host your DNS for you. So you can buy a domain through them or migrate your domain to them, and they will just automatically manage all of this DNS stuff for you.
and were your domains hosted with one of these popular providers that they had instructions for?
Yeah, I use Cloudflare, and that was well documented what to do.
Cool.
So within a matter of moments, the accounts were there and the DNS was updated. And because Cloudflare propagates DNS really quickly, email was suddenly starting to turn up in the new inboxes.
But that was a sigh of relief.
Well, yes, it was good that, you know, email was arriving. But then it was the, what do I do about all the email that's now in Gmail?
Yes.
And that was the really surprisingly simple bit. So you log into the account in Fastmail. You choose their migration option and you say, I've got an account on Google, and it says, right, we'll authenticate with Google. And then you get asked if you want to migrate mail, contacts or calendars, and you tick the boxes and say, okay. And it just sucks it all over.
Wow.
And it just worked. And I think I had close to 25,000 emails in my various, you know, folders and what have you. And that took 20 minutes. And my wife has 67,000 emails, and that took about 50 minutes.
Are you going to need all of those?
I didn't. I've actually purged a bunch more since then. But some of it's interesting. There's a lot of stuff from school, you know, going back. So maybe we could get rid of the junior school emails and things like this. Oh, but, you know.
Your daughter's
school. Yeah.
They didn't have email when Martin was in junior school.
No, but our email, because I've like moved the email as we've shuffled around over the years, our emails do go back to the 1990s. And when I did that import, this found 5,000 emails that Gmail had just lost sight of. So I got a folder of things where the Fastmail migration had found 5,000 emails that I knew I had somewhere. And even seeing them in Fastmail, if I go and expressly search for them in Gmail, it refuses to find them. So I don't know what magic was going on there, but that was interesting.
And can this, if you have your email just in like a standard like SMTP supported account, could it migrate from that as well? Or does it rely on having like a handful of services with API access?
So I haven't looked at what other services it can migrate from. I know that Gmail is not the only service that it can authenticate with and automatically hoover up email. And I think IMAP or POP3 were in there as well as options for hoovering up email.
That's what I meant, not SMTP. Yeah.
And what was quite nice and what I was concerned about is, well, what if DNS hasn't been updated everywhere and you still get occasional emails trickle into the old Gmail account? Automatically, Fastmail sets up a scheduled go and check for the new stuff. So it keeps an index of everything it's pulled over. And every so often it goes off and looks at your old account. And if there's anything new, it pulls it over for you, which I thought was a, you know, really slick.
Do you just use it via IMAP in some other mail client, or does it have a web UI like Gmail?
It does have a web UI. The web UI on like a browser desktop is much the same as the version you see on your phone. It is an app that you install on your phone, but I think it's just like a wrapper around the web app, and it's very good. Going into this, I was fully expecting that I was going to set up a desktop email client. But the killer feature is its UI. It's clearly designed by people that understand the business of sending and receiving and reading email. And I'm only using the web version. And in my opinion, this is the best email client I have used since Pegasus Mail.
Pegasus. Wow, you plucked that from the past, didn't you? Yes.
And I didn't just sort of randomly fall on that. The last time I actually liked using email was when I used Pegasus Mail on OS 2. So it was very nice to, A, have that migration just work. The app is unified, so your contacts, email, and calendar are all in the one application. So when you've got it on your phone, you just open the Fastmail app and all of those things are in there.
Does it do like group calendars so the family can like invite each other to stuff and you put stuff in each other's calendars?
Yeah, it does do group calendars, and it also does like group like email aliases and folders and things. So let's imagine you have an alias called shop at domain, which all of your emails from a given shop arrive to. You can set up rules and say, well, create this alias and deposit them into this folder and then share that folder with these people on the platform, and everyone gets that folder and those emails. It's really quite slick. The email filtering and rule creation system is sublime. It just works so well.
What are the downsides? What do you miss from Gmail?
Absolutely nothing.
How long has it been?
About 6 weeks now.
Okay.
And I could not be happier. It is email as it's meant to be. The only thing I was really concerned about is they had been writing on their website, this is Fastmail, for years about having an offline capability in the mobile app. And I thought this could be a problem. But that feature is in beta now, and you can turn that on if you want to use it. And it is really good because it isn't just like a cache of your stuff. You can prepare emails, label emails, put them in folders in an entirely offline state. And then when you come online, everything just magically gets synchronized.
Like Palm OS.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you two old farts.
Anyway, I feel like I've arrived at email nirvana again. Really am genuinely happy. So thank you to everyone in the Telegram channel who shared their email provider experiences. I could not be happier with Fastmail.
When you say you've reached your email nirvana, I think we are all of that generation. I have to lambast my son. He never reads emails, like even emails from like hospitals and doctors, important things, mm-hmm. passport office, you know, driving license notifications, all this kind of stuff. And I said, why don't you? And he said, well, email is for you old people. I just see it as a way to get my Fortnite two-factor authentication code. That's it. And I don't use it for anything else.
There is some truth to that. And one of the reasons why I've really hated Gmail is there is so much pointless emails that you get, and it all gets smashed together, and it's impossible to separate the signal from the noise. But Fastmail has allowed me to actually do that. The rules creation system and creating prefabricated searches. So I have searches of all new email today, regardless of like which folder it's in. So you can just see at a glance, this is all the new stuff, this is the stuff this week. When you pin things, you can still tuck it away in folders and then just give a pinned view. I know you can do this in Gmail, but it's just very elegant. I'm, as you can tell, very happy with Fastmail. It's fantastic. And if you're looking for an email provider, I wholeheartedly recommend it.
So your referral code will be in the show notes, right?
I hadn't thought of that, but why not?
Yeah, yeah, do it.